But because Ezekiel is the last, what we refer to as the last of the major prophets, we're finding ourselves introduced to Israel at their lowest point. We know that Israel, the 10 tribes, northern tribes, have been carried off long ago by the Assyrians and have been assimilated into their society. And then the Babylonians came along and bumped the Assyrians off. And we're not going to hear a whole lot about the northern 10 tribes anymore. They're gone. They won't ever come back. We know that because of Judah's rejection of God and the worshiping of idols, Judah's demise is in full swing. While Jeremiah spoke in of some brief times available to the Jews to repent, there isn't any opportunity offered to them at all to be saved from destruction in the book of Ezekiel. It doesn't mean, of course, that Ezekiel's book mentions no hope. We'll find that later on as we study. But as we study this book, we'll find there is some good news for the faithful, but those blessings are kept, as I mentioned, for a later time, after God's punishment for Judah's rebellion. And that punishment has now started. And, you know, God has always, his covenant relationship with these people has always been two-sided. God has kept his covenant relationship with them. They're the ones that have broken it time and time again, and God has punished them time and time again with various things, pestilence, famine, wars, this type of thing. But God also has a reputation to maintain. If the world is going to think of him as the real God, then he is going to, you can't have somebody represent him like Judah that is so, has so rejected him and allow that to go on. And so God has to show the world that he is God. And so now Judah has reached that point where their punishment has now started. Twice already, the resistance of Judah has resulted in threats and deportation. Jeremiah tells us about this, also 2 Kings and the Chronicles. 605 BC was the first, when Daniel and his friends, were familiar with them as Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego, although that wasn't their Jewish names, but one of the ones we are familiar with, they were taken to Babylon. That was the first one. Second one, saw Jehoiachin, taken to Babylon, and he was replaced by his uncle Zedekiah, who was installed, and eventually even he rebelled and pledged allegiance to Egypt. This is the beginning of Ezekiel's prophecy. This, of course, results in total destruction of Jerusalem, mass slaughter of the citizens there, starvation, pestilence, and a large exile from the promised land. In chapter 4 and following, We're going to see Ezekiel not only speak his message, but also act out God's message to the people. He's told to build a model of Jerusalem. Don't know how big this thing was. He's told some say a plate, some say a brick, but it was significantly large enough to draw this city of Jerusalem and depict an invading army that has completely surrounded the city and is besieging it with siege engines and rock throwers and towers, ramps against built up against the walls and this type of thing. Different books that I studied use different numbers. God had Ezekiel lay on his side. One of my studies says left side for 390 days and then 40 days on his right side. Another book I studied, commentary, said this was 190 days on his left side and 40 days on his right side. But regardless, he was told to lay on his left side for this 390 days and then 40 days on his right side. The left side was supposed to be significant or indicating the years that Israel, the 10 tribes of Israel, were in rebellion. And then the 40 days was 40 years that the rest of the Israelites, Judah, was involved in rebellion. I don't know if it also was a little bit difficult for anybody to really explain with any accuracy what these 390 and these 40 days meant. Some said, well, you know, it's the years that they were in rebellion. Okay. I don't know when that started and when it ended, but we know that Israel, the northern 10 tribes, were in rebellion for a long, long time, several hundred years. Also, they disappeared a couple of hundred years before Judah. And Judah's rebellion against God was a lot shorter. But it is a little bit difficult for them to explain the exact meaning of these days that Ezekiel was told to lay on his side. He was also told to cook his food over human waste. And he complained about this to the Lord. The Lord relented a little bit and told him to use animal waste. This meant that or represented that the Jews there in Jerusalem would eat defiled food. Animal waste that God relented and allowed Ezekiel to use was a common item that was used to cook and having and cook fires simply because there wasn't a whole lot of lumber available. And what lumber was available was too precious to burn for a cooking fire. So they used animal dung to do this, somewhat like pioneers did as they traveled across the country of the United States way back when in the 1800s. They did the same thing. In chapter 8, as we study tonight, we'll find that God picked up Ezekiel by his hair and transported him to Jerusalem to the temple. And hang on just 1 second. Boy. And then in chapter 10, we find that Ezekiel sees God depart from the temple, and God's glory leaving from above the mercy seat and departing through the east gate up onto the Mount of Olives, something that we are very familiar with and studied in the New Testament. Familiar with that. See that in chapter 12 and verse 23. And then I put together a few questions that's on the screen there. And let's see, where can we get down to number one? There we go. Okay. And in chapter 4, and don't forget, if you want to speak, be sure and unmute your microphone. In chapter 4, who can tell us where is Ezekiel at that time and what is he instructed to do?
Well, bless your heart. You already gave us the answer. He was told to make a model of Jerusalem and fortify it.
That is correct. I was wondering if anybody was listening to me.
Thank you.
Where was he?
Shabar, was it? I wasn't real sure about that, but I just put Shabar on my paper.
Yes, that is correct. He was in Babylon at this particular time, and he is putting together a model. He's mute at this time, by the way. He's only allowed to speak when God puts words in his mouth. But he is out there putting together this model. I'm sure that people had a wondering what in the world is he doing, what kind of silliness is going on and so forth like this. We've got to remember that God has fortified him. We've learned in earlier chapters that God has hardened his face, told him not to be afraid of these people. Don't be afraid of the abuse that you're going to be put through. You're going to be just as hard-hearted as they are, and you're going to not have any fear at all. So that's where he is. He's putting together this model, and I'm sure that it's done where everybody can see exactly what is it. And number two, I had, what is the significance of the 390 days and the 40 days, and what is Ezekiel told to do? We covered that briefly a few minutes ago. Does anybody have any, and the reason I put this in here is why, just to ask if anybody has any suggestions, other suggestions or anything like that about what significance these days have?
I see that one day equals a year. N is the judgment of Israel, and S is the judgment on Judah.
40 days, yes. Okay. Anybody have anything else? What is he told to do?
He has to bear the iniquity of Israel by doing these things.
Okay. Does anybody know how what he was supposed to eat?
Yes. Wheat, barley, beans, lentils, millet, spelt.
Supposed to take all those things and mix it up together into a, and make bread out of it. And this is what, showing what the people of Jerusalem were having to do. He was very limited on what he had available to eat. Wasn't very much. He was supposed to eat this every day. Also, as far as water was concerned, he was supposed to get 1 quart of water a day. I think it says a part of a hen. My references say that that was about a quart of water a day. So these are what I want to say, famine type rations. Not a whole lot available there, and a steady diet of the same thing every day. Let's read, let's see, number four. What was Ezekiel told to do with his hair?
Was to shave his hair.
Weigh it.
I'm sorry?
To cut it off and weigh it.
Okay.
And then he was supposed to do one-third, burn one-third in the center of the city, one-third strike it with the sword around the city, and one-third scatter it in the wind.
Okay, what was that supposed to represent?
His judgment on Jerusalem.
Okay, on the people?
Yes.
Okay, so what he's saying is that some of these people are going to be scattered to the four corners of the earth. Some are going to be killed and slaughtered in the city. And other ones are going to die of pestilence and so forth like that. But there were some that were saved. He had, I think he saved a portion of his hair, didn't he?
Saved.
Yeah.
I'm sorry?
That represented the remnant, the part that was going to be left that wasn't thrown in the fire.
Okay. And why, let's read Leviticus 26:14. And anybody want to read that? And also I need somebody to read Deuteronomy, the 28th chapter, verse 15 plus.
Okay, I'll read Leviticus 14.
Okay, and a few verses afterwards, if you would, Lenny, thanks.
But if you do not obey me and do not carry out all these commandments, if instead you reject my statutes, verse 15, and if your soul abhors my ordinances so as not to carry out all my commandments and so break my covenant, I in turn will do this to you. I will appoint over you a sudden terror, consumption, and fever that will waste away the eyes and cause the soul to pine away. Also, you will sow your seed uselessly, for your enemies will eat it up.
Okay, and Deuteronomy 28:15 plus.
And do not turn aside.
Go ahead.
Go ahead, Anne.
I do not turn aside from any of the words which I command you today, to the right or to the left, to go up after other gods to serve them. How far did you want me to read?
Just read the, go down 3 or 4 verses there.
But it shall come about, if you do not obey the Lord your God, to observe to do all his commandments and his statutes with which I charge you today, that all these curses will come upon you and overtake you. Cursed shall ye be in the city, and cursed shall ye be in the country. Cursed shall be your basket and your kneading bowl.
Okay, that's good. Thank you, Anne. And what these are the curses that God told them would be upon them. He originally said, hey, these curses will be upon your enemies. And this is reading back in Leviticus and Deuteronomy, books that Moses wrote, when the people were coming out or had come out of Egypt and were wandering throughout the wilderness. And God said, well, I'm going to make all these blessings for you. This is what I'm going to do for you, and this is what I'm going to do. Everything is just going to be very, very nice. But I'll tell you what I'm going to also do to you if you disobey me. I'm going to do to you what I've promised to do to your enemies. And here we have this brief outline of curses that God is going to do with them if they disobey him. And here, guess what? There's way down the way. They've just disobeyed him off and on for centuries. We know that. We've read it. We've studied it. And they never have been faithful in their longevity as far as God is concerned. Why in chapter 6, why is God referring to the mountains of Israel?
Yeah. The prophecy is against the mountains, because the mountains and the valleys were seats of idol worship, and it is the picture of the future of the judgment of the world.
Okay. Anybody else? What they have done is they've not only defiled the temple and brought in their pagan idols into the temple, but they, every nook and cranny in the hills, any grove of trees, any bunches of rocks they've set up and so forth like this all over the mountainsides in Judah, have little deities set up here and there, and they had their followers, their worshipers and so forth like this. And God is going to destroy these people. He's telling them that their dead bodies are going to foul the mountains all around their groves and so forth and so forth. Are going to be piles of dead bones and so forth like this. So they can't go anywhere. They get out of Jerusalem, they're going to be still be slaughtered. What does Galatians in number 7, what does Galatians 6, 7, and 8 say about God's principle? And is this the same statement in Ezekiel 7, 1 through 4 and 8?
Man sows to the flesh, he reaps corruption. Man who sows to the spirit reaps eternal life. God is not mocked. And yes, it is the same statement. God says he will bring all their abominations upon you.
Does God view idolatry as the most abominable kind of sin man can engage in?
I don't know if I could say that it's the most abominable kind of sin, but I do see it as the root of sin, because it's the step that man takes to replace God.
And God is a jealous God. He says he is.
And are there other forms of, how would you view idolatry? Would this be squatting in front of a deity, a rock or a stone or a piece of wood carved up? Are there other types of idolatry that we could engage in that would be would fall into a category of idolatry?
Anything that puts is more important than God. That's all in your life. Can be anything.
Okay.
A good friend of mine used to say that an idol is that without which we would be most uncomfortable. And I have heard it said that people, when they're asked a question, would you rather be without food or be without your phone? People say they'd rather be without food.
Yeah. Honey, would you give me a glass of water?
Yeah.
It's interesting what people will do for certain things. There's all kinds of idolatry. You could just put the love of money, put your money first. You know, there's people that will do anything. They just get fixated on one particular thing. one of my things used to be fishing. If I wasn't fishing, I never prayed to my rod. Well, I don't know. I might have prayed to God for, for a bite or something like that. But never got to that point. But I see a lot of people that are like that. They fixate on one particular thing.
Yes.
One particular thing, and that's all. And that can be a form of idolatry. I don't know about the most abominable sin, but it certainly ranks right up there as one of the worst that man can engage in. Who was Tammuz?
He was an Akkadian god. By the people of Judah before the temple was destroyed. These are the women that were weeping for him at the gates of the temple before the temple was destroyed.
Okay. And anybody else about who this was?
God of fertility.
Okay, that's true.
He's also known as Adonis.
Okay.
And there was a big festival for him, and he would come up in the springtime and then go down to the lower parts of the earth when it was fall, winter. There would be a big festival for him.
Yeah. And I had people weeping over this idol. In chapter 9, what instruction was given to the man with the inkwell? Remember now that Ezekiel has been taken up by his hair in a vision. His spirit has been taken up and deposited in the temple in Jerusalem. And he's seeing these things, and he's relating what he has seen. His physical body, does anybody know where his physical body was when his spirit was taken up? his physical body, and he was instructing some of the elders of the exiles there in Babylon when he received this vision, and his spirit was taken up and deposited at the temple in Jerusalem, and he saw these things, and it's telling us that what he saw was the same thing that he saw that he described in chapter 1. He saw the wheel, he saw the eyes, he saw the cherubims, he saw the throne, and he described that in detail in chapter 1, and here he is saying it. This was the same that he saw in chapter 1, but he saw this in Jerusalem in the temple. And he saw these people, and one of them was clothed in white, and he was given instruction to take this inkwell and go around through the city of Jerusalem and mark on the forehead of certain people. Who were these certain people that he was supposed to be marking?
The people that were weeping over the abominations taking place, I think, in the temple or just all around.
Okay, they were in the city of Jerusalem, and this man was supposed to go around and mark on people who were faithful. And they were bemoaning the terrible situation, what had happened to Jerusalem. They were faithful people. They had not departed from God's being faithful to God. And so these were the people that were to be spared. We know of no matter where most of these people went, they were going to be slaughtered. Terrible things were going to be happening to them. But these people that the man marked were to be spared from all this slaughter. Talked about the glory of God being there above the mercy seat. This would be in question number 11. Ezekiel saw the glory of God departing from Jerusalem. Thank you. Where did it go? Remember
it
that
went over. Oh,
go ahead.
Now I got to find my place again. He stood over the cherubim at the entrance of the last gate of the Lord's house.
Okay. And Ezekiel is watching the glory of the Lord, Spirit of the Lord, depart from the temple there in Jerusalem. And it went out the east gate, did it not?
Yes.
Okay, and where did it go when it left East Gate? I think I mentioned that when I was first got started this afternoon. It went to the hill east, to the east, which was the Mount of Olives. And we of course know and are very familiar with that. In chapter 11, does God assure Ezekiel a remnant will be preserved and returned to Jerusalem?
Yes, with the new spirit and one heart. So new covenant.
Okay. What does this signify, Dean?
Well, as I have thought about the remnant, this is a frequent discussion in the prophets, and it's an indication that no matter how bad Israel got, there was always a group that remained faithful to God, and God always protected that group. He always brought them back. You know, we think about it in terms of Jerusalem and the remnant that was spared. You think about the Christians as the remnant that was spared when Rome came against Jerusalem, and the remnant listened to Jesus' warning and they went out into the mountains. There's throughout history, there has always been a group of people that wanted to serve God. And even during the Dark Ages, the worst possible times that you can think of, there's always been the faithful group. And it's hard for us to remember that. It was kind of like Jeremiah, who had to be reminded, hey, I still have people who are serving me in this city. It's not the most powerful people. It's not the people that are in charge, but I still have 7,000 people who've not bowed the knee to Baal. And you always have to remember that. No matter how powerful it appears that Satan and his influences are, he will not prevail against the church. He will not eliminate all of the people that want to serve God.
That's I appreciate what you're saying, because a question that pops into my mind from time to time is, what about when the Catholics rule the world? Tortured people, if they had anything to say against the prevailing philosophy, burnt people at the stake, this type of thing. All this time during what we refer to as the Dark Ages, there's no mention of the church other than the Catholic Church. Did God's family survive that? Were there righteous people during that period of time? And I think you answered that. That's a question that pops up and has popped up in my mind for a long time now and again. And, I asked Jerry Bassett about that one time, and he said, oh, yes. He said they were, might have met in the dungeons and so forth like this, but there were faithful people who worshiped the Lord back in those days. And mainly, God just would not let it die out.
I understand, Ron, that in parts of Northern Europe, there are cemeteries where the inscription on headstones says simply a Christian. And you find those kinds of things throughout time. If like you were saying, it may seem like the forces of evil have prevailed, but mm-hmm. they have not. It's hard to remember that, but it is nevertheless true. The forces of evil will not prevail. When Jesus made that statement to Peter, that I will build my church and the gates of hell will not prevail against it, I think the emphasis right there was, I'm going to build my church and Satan can't prevent me from doing that, no matter what he does. But beyond preventing Jesus from establishing the church, Satan cannot prevail against the church once it's established. It will continue. And I take great consolation in that, because I try not to be an alarmist. I try not to be a fatalist, but I see our country and other countries in the world that are becoming antagonistic toward the people of God. And I just take comfort in the fact that I know that they, excuse me, antagonistic forces may put me to death, but they will never eliminate the church.
There's always going to be somebody who survives. That's true. Okay, well, thank you so much, Dean. I'm about running out of steam here. Anybody have any comments to make about our study tonight?
Ron, this last verse where he's reassuring the people who are in Babylon that a remnant will be preserved and returned to Jerusalem reminds me of where it said that God is not going to be, where Jesus says God is not going to be worshipped in the mountains or in Jerusalem. He's going to be worshipped everywhere. It's just a reassurance that God is in control.
Yeah, it's well, and I think this is probably where the who was it? It might have been Ted that mentioned this. I can't recall. About when the synagogue started coming into being was because people were scattered everywhere. Jerusalem is gone, the temple is gone, and it's going to be gone for a long time. But we know God is everywhere, has always been everywhere. And even though he recited, or that was his place, in Jerusalem in the temple, he departed from it. And, an interesting study. It's been a lot of fun so far for me to, we haven't got into a lot of the, ideas, different ideas, where these prophecies point us to, and what's going to be available to the people in the coming years and so forth like that. But we'll get into that. It'll be a fun study. Next week, we'll go chapters 12 through 16. Excuse me. So if you will, study chapters 12, 16, just briefly, and go through that, appreciate it very much, and be ready to we'll talk about those things coming up. So.